This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For the past 17 years, gays and lesbians have been allowed to serve in the military only if their sexual orientation remains a secret. Last month, the Pentagon released a report concluding that repealing the law and allowing gays to serve openly would present only a low risk to the military's effectiveness, even during wartime. Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said that repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a matter of urgency, because if Congress doesn't act, a court decision could impose immediate repeal, leaving the military no time for preparation. But yesterday, Gates expressed skepticism that the lame duck Congress would bring the issue to a vote. My guest, Nathaniel Frank, is a historian who wrote a report earlier this year on why and how five countries changed their policies to allow gays and lesbians to serve openly in the military: Britain, Israel, Canada, South Africa, and Australia. His report was published by the Palm Center of the University of California, Santa Barbara, where he was the senior research fellow. He's also the author of a book about the impact of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, called Unfriendly Fire. Nathaniel Frank, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
Would you give us an overview of which countries have militaries that don't allow gays and lesbians to serve and which do?
Sure. Most of the countries in Western Europe now allow gays to serve, including the United Kingdom, our closest ally, and probably the best analogy for the U.S., France, and Italy, Spain. Also some that might be surprising, South Africa, Uruguay, in parts of other parts of the world. In Asia and Africa, there are often no policies at all, and they are either because homosexuality is so often unspoken about or because there are civilian laws against it, and there you can assume that it's not allowed.
And what about if you're just looking at NATO?
Within NATO, there are about 35 countries that appear to let gays and lesbians serve. It just depends on whether you're looking for an outright policy allowing it or simply the lack of a policy banning it. So there are at least 25 countries that researchers have confirmed allow gays and lesbians to serve openly. And that number goes to about 35 if you look at simply which countries don't have a ban.
Is there any other country in the world that has a policy like Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
No, there really isn't. Historically, there had been policies that in practice were similar, so that there might be something where you would be denied security clearance if you were suspected to be gay or lesbian, but it wasn't a written down policy. Or there would be euphemisms, carnal and unnatural behavior in the old days, something about morality, under which commanders would discharge you. In Israel, for a period of time, if you said you were gay or you were suspected of being gay, you would be referred to a mandatory psychiatric evaluation, and in some cases that could lead to a discharge. So there have been similar kinds of policies in practice, but there's nothing that's been codified into a law in any other part of the world that actually said we will allow gays to serve if they pretend, in a sense, that they're not gay.
So let's look at Britain. Now, one of the concerns that Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, have said is that they fear that the court challenge making its way through the system now will end up reversing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And if it happens through the courts, the military is concerned that they won't be able to do it in their own timely fashion.
Right, in an orderly fashion is the phrase that they've been using. That's right. It's very rare that this kind of a change comes about by military personnel simply standing up and saying, we would like to now allow gays. It almost always comes through pressure of some kind or another, in many cases mirroring where the culture is at that time. But of course, there's lags and there are gaps sometimes. In Britain, there was a court case brought in the early 1990s that made its way through the British court and actually lost. So the ban remained. But the court warned the military that although we are upholding your right to have a ban, the European Court of Human Rights is not likely to find this okay. And so that triggered a series of events where the military created a commission similar to the one that the U.S. created and just gave its report recently, to assess their policy. Now, even that commission actually recommended retaining the ban. But as is often the case with many other countries and is also playing out here in the U.S., there was a court case. It didn't win, but it raised concern that the ban was on its last legs. And the military ordered a relaxation of enforcement. So in many, many cases, the actual end of a gay ban is preceded by a court case and a relaxation of enforcement. And then sure enough, when that case wound its way up to and through the European Court of Human Rights in 1999, that court struck it down. And just 4 months later, the military lifted the ban and accepted the court case.
So the military is basically forced to change.
That's
in
right.
England.
It was.
So once it was forced to change, how did it go about figuring out what the new policy was going to be and how gays and lesbians in the military were going to be treated?
Well, that's the question that so many people have been asking. And what's kind of funny about it is that it's largely been much ado about nothing. There isn't very much to do. You know, people are talking here about years of training and education and what will the policy be. Some people have said, well, don't ask, don't tell ought to go, but what on earth would we replace it with? This is not like racial integration where you actually have to – in some senses it is, but this is not like racial integration in that you're moving massive amounts of personnel around. All it really means, to minimize it for a moment, is that you stop kicking out gay people, that you let them serve. There's already gay people, in other words, in these militaries. It's about whether you acknowledge it, whether you allow it, whether you allow gay and lesbian people to be honest. And so in Britain, it was 3.5 months after the court case, and they simply issued regulations saying this was now allowed. There was a minimal amount of training. There were sessions with leaders to make it absolutely clear that they would have buy-in. So certainly there were steps taken, but there isn't an enormous amount that needs to be done or that has been done in these other countries beyond ceasing to fire people and making clear that the new policy is that gay people will be allowed, that they'll be respected, and in some cases there is an additional code of conduct that is promulgated in order to make those regulations clear.
Now let's look at Canada. Canada relaxed its ban on gays in the military in 1988. When did it actually lift it?
In 1992. So Canada, like Britain, did start by relaxing its ban. It had a charter of rights and freedoms that it adopted in 1985. And in 1986, amidst some pressure, it also, like Britain, created a commission to study its policy on gays and lesbians. Interestingly, in both cases, these surveys, these studies similar to the one in the U.S., surveyed service members to ask them their attitudes, their feelings, their views about lifting the ban. In both cases, in Britain and Canada, and these are very large surveys, majorities said that they would not support serving with gays and lesbians. Some actually said, large percentages said that they would refuse to serve, that they would leave, that they wouldn't work with gays and lesbians. And yet when the transitions were actually made, almost no one left. So there's a big gap between what people say and what actually happens. Partly because of these surveys, both in Britain and Canada, the commissions recommended against lifting the ban because they were taking too seriously, I think, these stated concerns based on opinion surveys that don't actually measure the likely impact on cohesion of repealing a policy. They are really just opinion polls. And so Canada also recommended against repeal, but the court case went through and the military lost at a lower level and the military actually settled because they knew they wouldn't win.
So was Canada as swift in implementing the end of the gay ban as England was? England did it within 4 months of the court case.
Actually, Canada was quicker, and so was Australia, and so was Israel. Australia and Israel didn't go through court cases, but taking 3.5 months for Britain between the court ruling and the implementation was among the longest of the countries that researchers have looked at. In many cases, the change was literally done overnight or within a week. There was a court decision and the gay ban was over, or there was a decision made by some other government department and the ban was over. Again, this is because gay people are already serving in these militaries, and although there are useful analogies to integrating women in combat or racial integration. The difference is that this is more about acknowledging something that's already there than actually moving personnel around. And so there's less of an argument for taking so much time, notwithstanding that's what we see here in the U.S., is that the military seems to want to have time to make the change.
Let's look at Israel, one of the other countries that you studied. Israel is acknowledged to have a very strong military. Service is compulsory for men and women. Was there a ban on gays in the military?
Israel did limit service by gays and lesbians, but it limited it by requiring a psychiatric evaluation, which would often trigger a discharge based on some kind of euphemism, that you were mentally unfit or the service was inappropriate or you were unsuitable. In an earlier era, earlier in the 20th century, that was almost universal. By the 1970s and 80s, that was more discretionary, so some people would be discharged and some people wouldn't. In 1983, the ban was relaxed but also formalized in another way, and that often happens. A lot of these countries, actually, their bans were short-lived and that they were ironically developed just as civilian laws and customs about homosexuality were relaxing. And so the military felt that since it could no longer rely on civilian laws to root out gays, they would have to develop their own policies. And so some of them were very short-lived. Israel is a very instructive case because it is a combat-tested ally. Although there are important differences between Israel and the U.S., such a small country, people often go home at the end of the day. There is conscription. It's not a volunteer force. There are men and women. And some of these differences have been used by people to say that that case is not instructive. And yet the fears were exactly the same. The opposition to letting gays serve were the same. The language of mental instability and unsuitability and concerns about intimacy and that sort of thing were all very much the same. And ultimately, the research on Israel and Britain and Canada and Australia and South Africa has been very uniform. That despite concerns in all of these countries, there have been no overall problems. So in other words, there would be isolated disruptions here or there, which are equivalent to any other number of personnel conflicts, you know, individuals not getting along, someone maybe asking for a transfer or something like that. So it doesn't mean that all resistance evaporated, but at the level of unit cohesion, at the level of recruitment and retention and readiness and battle effectiveness, all of the criteria people use rightly to assess whether there is harm caused by lifting a gay ban, there has been nothing. It's been impossible to find an example of overall cohesion suffering from lifting a ban. Again, it doesn't mean that there aren't people who resisted. In some cases, the reinstatement of a gay person amidst media spotlights may have caused a kind of ruckus. And some people say, look, this is what happens when you let gays serve. But of course, that's really something that happens when you make a fight out of it in the first place. The fact of being gay or lesbian and serving openly in these countries has caused no overall harm.
You said that there really weren't any major problems in the five countries that you studied when they ended their bans on gays and lesbians in the military. But it seems a little hard to imagine that the transition would be so smooth, especially like when you consider when women started going to West Point. There were stories about rape and unfair treatment and, you know, harassment, all kinds of things that they had – that the women had to deal with. And obviously some of the men had a real hard time dealing with women. So was there nothing comparable that you found in the five countries when gays and lesbians could openly serve?
Well, I understand the skepticism when you say that uniformly there were no problems. And it's important to make clear that there were isolated incidents of people grumbling, of interpersonal conflicts, of someone perhaps requesting that they can change a room or a unit. But I've been studying this for 10 years, and the military itself and universities and government, Congressional Research Service, has also been studying this for years. And it's one of the things that drew me to this policy as a research topic, was that the evidence is overwhelming that there actually have not been overall problems to cohesion, retention, recruitment, and battle effectiveness. And yet the culture and the political landscape continues to retain the ban. Now, I think some of what makes this different from women in combat or racial integration is that you have to remember that gays have already been in the military, in many cases even serving openly, notwithstanding the policy, because it's not enforced well. It's unenforceable in some senses. So this is unlike a situation where you have a new group show up at the door. It's more about acknowledging something that most people know already exists. And as far as harassment or something like that, there's already a level of harassment against all kinds of people, gays and lesbians included. But it makes sense that that harassment would actually be alleviated once you can talk about this, once this comes above ground, because the ban on saying that you're gay actually leads to further harassment because it doesn't allow people to report it without worrying that they'll come under scrutiny. So there are many unanticipated benefits of lifting a ban. In Canada, when their ban was lifted, harassment against women went down by 60-some percent. Now, we can't say that's all because of the ban being lifted, because you don't want to make that kind of correlation without knowing why it happened. But it's suggestive of the fact that driving something like this underground actually makes things worse. And when you simply say people can be open and honest and they can report harassment, it may make things better.
So if you look at all five countries that you studied, so we're talking about Canada, Britain, South Africa, Israel, and Australia, things they have in common include once the military decided or was forced to change, you know, reverse its ban on gays in the military, they implemented the change swiftly. And as far as you can tell, there weren't any problems, major problems. And also, there were no separate quarters, no separate facilities, no separate policies for gays and lesbians.
That's right. And it's not just as far as I can tell. I mean, so many different sources have conducted research since the early 1990s, before, during, and after transitions. The RAND Corporation, which is a which has again been hired to do a study, as it did in 1993 for the Clinton-era effort to lift the ban. And the RAND Corporation was
hired
by the military, and the RAND Corporation was started by military officers after World War II, so it has close ties to the military. Brookings Institution, the Center for American Progress, but also the military itself, its own research arms, as well as the Government Accountability Office and the Palm Center and other academic think tanks, have all done studies to assess, and now the Pentagon Working Group, what has happened in other countries. And there simply is no evidence showing problems, and there's overwhelming evidence showing that these transitions are a non-event and that they can occur. So the similarities are manifold, and they are that there were major concerns about disruptions to effectiveness and recruitment and retention, and that none of them came true on any wide scale.
One of the surprises in your chapter on Britain, surprise to me, is that the Royal Air Force created a relationship with the gay rights group Stonewall. What was that relationship about?
The military found that it was an employer of first resort to gay and lesbian people, that there had been longstanding interest by gay and lesbian people serving in the military. They had always been there, and that when the military does something, and this is a feature of military culture, it does it wholeheartedly. And it found that it was a very appealing employer and quickly made it on the a list of a gay rights group's top 100 employers for gay and lesbian people. And so it capitalized on that, and it went to gay pride parades in London and throughout Britain.
The military did.
You know, it took a few years, and it varied by service branch, but the ban was lifted in 2000, and by 2006 and 7, the military was having a presence at gay rights parades, gay pride parades, and was liaisoning very deliberately with these groups. And it's a recognition, I think, of how wholeheartedly the military really embraced what it was doing, which was that equality was good for the military and that it was a better command climate when you didn't have people snooping and wondering about rumors and suspicions, and when you said every team member is going to excel because every team member is going to be treated as a team member. And I think going out and saying, you know, we're not just doing this because we were ordered to by a court, but we're doing this because we recognize that this is actually good for the command climate was part of what was happening when they developed formal ties with gay rights groups in order to say we're actually going to engage with the gay community in hopes that they will feel 100% welcome in the military.
Now, what interested you most or surprised you most in America's Pentagon study on gays in the military that was recently released?
Well, in some ways, the Pentagon's recent study has mirrored what decades of other research into the question of gay service have said, which is that openly gay service works and it works well. And so that wasn't surprising, although I think people were heartened that the study was done with good faith and done effectively and that it mirrored other academic research. I think what was surprising is just how positive a climate it found in terms of openness to openly gay service. You know, this is a generation, the younger people in the military, that has passed out of the concerns of a lot of the older people who are running the military at upper levels. And a lot of research has been saying that for a while, but now the military has seen for itself and duly reflected that evolution. So to see that 70% of service members think that lifting the ban would be positive or neutral, but not, you know, or mixed, but not negative, that was quite something. And I think to see that in a very comprehensive study, there was a lot of research reflected about how lifting a gay ban is not just something that can be tolerated, but can actually improve command climate, which is what other countries found. I think that was, not something that I necessarily expected would be reflected in the report.
Now, you've pointed out in your study that most of the five countries that you studied changed their ban, ended their ban on gays in the military because there were court cases that were going to force them to change or that did force them to change. There's a case that's making its way through the courts now, filed by the Log Cabin Republicans, and they're saying there should be gays in the military who can serve openly. It's now on appeals, and a federal court is going to hear the appeal probably in February. How would you compare that case to the cases in the five countries, you know, in the countries that you studied?
Well, I think the case is similar and the history is similar in that a court case emerges that shows that the culture has come a certain distance from the past where a court case wouldn't have even made its way this far. One of the differences, though, is that we have a don't ask, don't tell policy, which is that there are already gay people in the military. And, of course, in these other countries there were too, but it wasn't formally acknowledged the way it is under don't ask, don't tell. But I do think that the court cases have always created pressure toward ending these policies because, you know, the Pentagon doesn't want to deal with the uncertainty of the possibility of a judge imposing this overnight. And that is, in fact, exactly what happened in the last few months is that a single federal judge at the district level imposed a worldwide injunction. And there were some wrangling over whether she even had the authority to do that. But eventually the Pentagon accepted that she did. And for 8 days, there was no ban. And you had military officials saying, you know, grumbling about the court case and saying this could create enormous consequences. And yet you have the evidence of at least a week of no ban without any consequences. So that is also a political concern, that leaders who are trying to make this a gradual process, either because of their own resistance or because they want to generate buy-in by all the stakeholders in the military, they would rather control this themselves. And that's what the current legislation in the U.S. Congress does, is it doesn't repeal don't ask, don't tell immediately. It gets repeal past Congress as a hurdle, which it's been for 17 years, and puts it in the hands of the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the President to say, we're now ready when they're ready. when they've been satisfied that all the preparations are in place to end the ban.
On the other hand, the commander of the Marine Corps and the chiefs of staff of the Army and Air Force told the said last week that this isn't the time to change the policy because we're fighting a war. So there still is resistance at a high leadership level within the armed services.
There's certainly divided opinion, although if you actually look at what, for instance, the Air Force chief said in terms of this political moment, he said he would like to delay repeal for another year or so, but he does think the legislation should move forward so that the military has the control over that. But again, when you look at the evidence, you look at the research, you look at what the courts have said, and now look at what the military has said, it becomes harder and harder in court to defend the existing policy. It becomes harder and harder to say this policy had or has a rational basis when all of the research, including the military's own research and many of its top leaders, though not all, are saying this policy is compromising our effectiveness, our integrity, and our talent pool. And so even the court's tradition of deferring to the military is now thrown into question.
And conflicts that the American military has been involved with lately, there have been multinational forces from NATO countries, from other countries. There was, you know, President Bush's coalition of the willing, in which American troops served alongside troops from all over the world. Now, many of the armies that the United States has served alongside with have policies that allow gays to serve. What has been the outcome of that? Have there been any conflicts there, serving with militaries that have openly gay people?
Well, there certainly has been no evidence that these multinational forces that do include openly gay people have become problems at the overall level. You know, you can't say that no one has complained or that there haven't been interpersonal conflicts, but the research I've done and research others have done have looked into those cases, not just the policy on paper that allows openly gay service, but speaking to, interviewing people who have been openly gay, there's been an increase in the number of joint military operations in the past few decades. And there are absolutely openly gay service members from other countries serving alongside and in some cases commanding U.S. troops in the Middle East, in Sinai, in Ethiopia and Lebanon, as well as in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. There are documented evidence of openly gay British commanders commanding U.S. troops on ships for a period of time where it was known that these people were gay and there were no issues. And so I think that's more evidence that openly gay service works without causing overall disruptions.
Well, Nathaniel Frank, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Nathaniel Frank is the chief author of the report Gays in Foreign Militaries 2010, A Global Primer, which was published by the Palm Center of the University of California, Santa Barbara. You can find a link to the report and read an excerpt of Frank's book, Unfriendly Fire, about the impact of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, Tanya Hamilton, the writer and director of the new film Night Catches Us, starring Kerry Washington and Anthony Mackie as former Black Panthers. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Tanya Hamilton, is the writer and director of the new independent film Night Catches Us. It's nominated for an Independent Spirit Award for Best First Feature. Set in 1976, it's about a group of people in a Philadelphia neighborhood who had been members of the militant group the Black Panthers. While some are trying to settle scores from the past, others are trying to move on with their lives. Tensions between the community and the police remain high. Kerry Washington plays a former Panther whose husband, Neil, was killed by the police. Her husband's best friend, Marcus, is the man the Panthers blamed for snitching to the police and getting Neil killed. Marcus moved out of the city, but has returned for his father's funeral. Marcus is played by Anthony Mackie, who co-starred in The Hurt Locker. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott described Night Catches Us as a politically sophisticated and ethically serious film that touches deep reservoirs of anger, but is impelled more by sorrow and the desire for wisdom. Filmmaker Tanya Hamilton was born in Jamaica and moved to the U.S. with her mother when she was 8. Here's a scene from the film in which Kerry Washington's character, Patricia, is trying to explain to her 8-year-old daughter how her father, Neil, was killed.
The year you were born, Two panthers were killed by the police. And your father was outraged. So he and some other panther members, they decided they were going to kill a police officer. And I tried to convince him not to. We all did. Marcus and Uncle Do-Right. But he wouldn't listen.
Did he do it?
But that's not who we were. That's not what we did. Your father became angry, disillusioned, maybe. You were 8 months old, and nobody was safe. I didn't know how I was going to keep this family together. The night they caught me, we were taking you to my parents.
Tonya Hamilton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Your movie, Night Catches Us, is in part about the afterlife of radical activism, the impact of that on the characters a few years after. And the Kerry Washington character is a lawyer, and her goal is to help the people in the neighborhood, to bail them out when they need it, to defend them when they need it. But her cousin, Jimmy, he's 18. He grew up seeing the Panthers, but he was too young to be part of them. And he idolizes the whole idea of it. He loves the clothes they wore, the leather jackets, the beret, the fist salute, the guns. But he's totally not cognizant of the politics. So all he wants to do is be nasty to the cops and without really understanding the kind of political struggle and the social issues that created the Black Panthers, that the Panthers stood for. Why were you interested in creating that character?
I saw this film on a couple different levels. Like I felt like it needed to talk not only kind of about the waning days, but about sort of what ultimately destroyed the Panthers and the complexity of that destruction. So like there's what we know, which is that, you know, the government goes after them and sort of squeezes really hard until they pop. But I also felt like there was something about the community that was culpable as well. You know, as uncomfortable as that feels, I wanted to be able to talk about it. And I thought that Jimmy represented a couple things. One, I thought he sort of represented a lot of the kids I went to high school with in the 80s. You know, like I went to high school in D.C., and that, you know, at the time it was the murder capital, basically, of the U.S. And I knew a lot of people who died over just nonsense. And I thought, well, what's the great sadness of the demise of something like the Panthers, which is essentially at its core, at its most beautiful place, a grassroots organization that's inside of a community whose objective ultimately is to bolster that community and to help it grow and to live. And I think that the result is what you get in the 80s, which is kids who kind of, in a way, are wayward a little bit, or wayward emotionally, don't have a place to kind of be grounded. And then I think you see the certain kind of destruction that happens. And I think that Jimmy, as a character, is someone who borrows somebody else's history without really fully understanding where it comes from and how it's been fought for.
But he seems to like the pose most of all.
Yeah, I mean, I think
the pose and the idea of like confrontation.
Yeah, yeah. I thought about him as like this guy who would have been, you know, like 9 or 10 when they were around, which is young enough, I think, to kind of have something make an indelible mark on your soul, but not old enough, I think, to really recognize all the minutiae. You know, it's sort of like
the main event part, really.
It's true. Although I will say that I think that they were such fashionistas that actually is the thing that I felt like Jimmy's kind of like us a little bit. It's sort of like what we remember about them is sort of like sexy Black men with guns. But it really was in the minutiae of what made them special. It was the small things that they thought of, the breakfast programs, which of course are big, but you know what I mean? It's the stuff, it's the work. That's what made them special. And then the fashionista stuff was the stuff that made them gorgeously extraordinary. You know, they were able to kind of work it.
When were you first exposed to the politics, the rhetoric, the more romantic, as you put it, fashionista part of the Panther period?
I was a painter for a long time, all through high school and all through college. And I was always a big fan of this guy, Emory Douglas, who was the Black Panther Party's Minister of Culture. And he was their artist. You see his stuff everywhere, the rays of light. I mean, people like Shepard Fairey, I mean, all of those people are very influenced ultimately by this guy. And so we use Emory Douglas's work in the film. It's all throughout the opening of the film. And then we use little pieces kind of throughout, you know, kind of the body of the movie. And
they're paintings or drawings?
They're just these massive illustrations.
Of Black Panthers?
Of Black Panthers. He was their propagandist. And I think he borrowed heavily from the Chinese and from the Cubans and you know.
That kind of social realist style?
Yeah, it was very, you know, it had a Diego Rivera, you know, sort of
The working man.
Exactly, yeah. Like the WPA kind of, you know, the potato-eating, you know, working class. And beautiful, like the colors, you know, the beauty of that revolutionary red.
One of the issues confronted in the film is whether to stay or leave the neighborhood. Both Kerry Washington's character and Anthony Mackie's character are former Black Panthers. Kerry Washington wants to stay in the neighborhood and help the people there with her legal skills, because she's a lawyer, bail them out, defend them, feed the children who don't have enough food. So she's like a professional and a community provider and activist. The Anthony Mackie character was basically driven out of the neighborhood because he's been accused of being a snitch. And he wants to stay out of the neighborhood and make a better life for himself. And it's an interesting division that you're working with there about how to respond to a neighborhood that has its problems, that has violence, that has a history of confrontation, where the police have been confrontational with them and vice versa.
What I liked about Philadelphia is that it is sort of the city of all of these neighborhoods, and that is a great beauty of this town. I thought that in the pure essence of the Panthers, that they were about community and they were all about how do I kind of make my community strong. What I find interesting is that despite the breakup of the group, however many years ago, that all of the people that I've met who were part of the party, and again, I'm 42 years old. I wasn't a part of the Panthers. You know, I'm from Jamaica, like, you know, but they all had this obsession with where they live. And they all do things like, you know, whether it's they're part of community groups or there's a guy named Jamal Joseph in New York who was one of the Panther 21. He was, I think, the youngest member to become a part of the leadership of the party. I think he joined when he was 15, maybe. You know, he's got this group of kids. I was there a couple weeks ago and called Impact. And he trains these kids to sing and to dance. And they're just like these working kids, you know, from the neighborhood. Jamie Hector, who's one of the actors from The Wire, who's in this film, he plays Do Right, is sort of similar. It's really interesting that he has this, you know, kind of community organization out in Brooklyn where he teaches these kids how to act. I mean, I really admire that. And I think that people who are drawn to organizations like the Panthers, they all have this great desire to make the place where they live and where their kids are going to live a lot better.
Night Catches Us is shot in Germantown, a neighborhood in Philadelphia. It looks very 70s. It's set in 1976 and it looks it. How did you find locations that would look 70s enough?
Well, my sense is that Philly hasn't changed all that much since the 70s. the producers wanted to move the film out of Philly to New York at a certain point because it was just going to be cheaper for their tax credit, et cetera, et cetera. And myself and one other producer really just fought very hard to keep it here. And I think in part because I had lived here for 9 years at that point. I was like, this is the perfect town. Germantown is this magical place, and it hasn't changed for a really long time, for the good in some places and for the tremendous bad in others. So we just kind of drove around, and we just kind of pointed to blocks that made sense for us. And, you know, we had to deal with street signs and stuff like that, that we, you know, there's some cell phone towers if you look very carefully. You know, that we couldn't get rid of because our budget was really tiny.
You use a lot of still photographs, some documentary footage of the Panthers, I guess I'm interested in if there's any of the real images that you used that were particularly intriguing or powerful for you. I mean, part of what the Panthers did, like some other radical groups of the 60s and 70s, is really bring a knowing sense of theater to what they were doing through what they wore, through the poses that they used for photographs and for posters. Like the Yippies used theater, the Panthers used theater. And I don't mean stage theater. I just mean,
yeah.
Was any of that imagery particularly powerful for you looking at it?
I mean, I think all of it was. I mean, you know, there's some stuff of Fred Hampton that I thought was just beautiful, of him talking. I think we slowed it down in the film, but it's just him on a podium talking. And Fred Hampton is, he was from the Chicago chapter of the Panthers, and he was murdered by Chicago police in his bed. And he was very young. I mean, I want to say maybe 21, 22, something like that. And I think a lot of people really thought that he was going to be the kind of replace Newton in a way, and Huey Newton, who was the head of one of the co-founders of the Panthers, because he was so eloquent and so far-seeing in a way, and he was a great community organizer. But I you know, there are some images from a documentary about him that I really loved, and there's some imagery of these guys kind of sitting around with like a gun. You know, they're loading their guns, and it's maybe there are five or six of them in a room. And you know, and I will say one thing: there was one piece that I love so much, and it's a shot of the Panthers at, I believe it's Fred Hampton's funeral, and we use it in the film. It's a panning shot across all of their faces. They're in their berets, and they have suits on, and they have, like, I think, like a white flower, and it's just this panning shot of them, and it's so heartbreaking in a way. They look almost like they have been really defeated, you know, really kind of broken, and I wanted to use that shot. And I remember we couldn't find, like, who owned it, and it was, like, this big search, and there was a sigh of relief when we finally figured out who it was and that we could license it, because I just really felt like it was it was this metaphor, in a way, of this punishing kind of squeeze that they go through. And then in the end, you realize that so many of them are actually just kids, 21, 23, 25, you know, just it's a beautiful piece of footage.
Since two of the actors in your movie were in The Wire, Jimmy Hector, who played Marlo Stanfield, the really crazy drug dealer, and Wendell Pierce, who played Bunk, a cop. I couldn't help but wonder if you'd had worked on The Wire at all. I know
No, but I'm a devotee. I love The Wire. I mean, I think it's – I felt like it really in an interesting way. Like, I was with Jimmy Hector yesterday in New York, so we had to do something. And walking down the street with that guy, you're stopped, you know, sort of every, like, quarter of a block.
People recognize him?
People recognize him.
What did they say to him when they stopped him? Because, really, his character is like a sociopath. He's crazy.
Yeah, in a very calm way.
But his eyes are really –
Yeah.
You could tell in his eyes he's crazy.
It's interesting because Jamie Hector is the opposite of that character, which sounds cliche, but it's actually very true. He's an extremely sweet person. He's not insane.
Mm-hmm.
you know, so it's funny in a way to kind of see these two personas, and people will be like, Marlo! You know, like from like across the street. And then he's so kind, you know, he'll stop and like, you know, and they'll come up to him. And the conversation is in this, you know, it's not who are you and hi. It's generally, you know, at least from my experience yesterday and a couple other times, it's Marlo. It's having this discussion as though they're speaking to Marlo, which I, you know, you hear that. Nobody's delusional. Like, they know it's an actor. And yet I think that there's such a connection to that character.
Your movie's called Night Catches Us. It sounds like it's a quote from a poem or something. No one says that line in the movie. And I'd really like to know where the title comes from.
Well, in Jamaica, there's a saying, you know, my grandmother might say, if I'm going out, don't let night catch you. And that simply means come back at a decent hour. You don't want to stay out. I mean, it's a very literal kind of thing, Jamaican patois, and it just really means you don't want to stay out until night catches up to you. When we were searching for a title, and this film had a different title for a very long time, and as the movie evolved and the Marcus character became much more of the focus of the film, because it used to really be about the kid, I felt like the title that we had previously was far too sweet. So we started searching for a new one, and I felt like the film is about these people who are all running in these various directions, and I felt like there was something nicely noirish about Night Catches Us, and that it it spoke in a way, if you kind of wanted to kind of dissect it, of their history, and was it going to catch up to them, and were they going to have to contend with it, and you know, it, the night sort of in a way being the metaphor of one's past, and how, you know, no matter what, it was going to kind of run them over, and they were going to have to eventually kind of deal with what they were holding back. So yeah, and it wasn't my idea, actually, it was my husband's.
Oh, well, good for him. Okay. Tonya Hamilton, thank you very much, and good luck with the movie.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tonya Hamilton wrote and directed the new film Night Catches Us. You can see clips on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. I'm Terry Gross.